We're in a series of lessons called Journey Life, and we've been looking at different characters from the Old Testament and trying to draw lessons to help us in our daily walk with God. And about 3 weeks ago, John Micah began our series on Joseph. And boy, he did just an awesome job talking about the kind of family that Joseph came from. You know, if you're not careful, I remember as a kid growing up that the Bible characters were kind of these holier-than-everybody-else characters. I mean, I thought, boy, these men and women of God had it together. Until I started reading the good book. And of course, you start reading your Bible and you realize right fast, wow, not only did they not have it together, but boy, they were messed up. And John, as he introduced us to the family of Jacob, said, you want to talk about a dysfunctional family? They were truly messed up. And he talked about the hatred that Joseph's brothers had toward him and the conflict it created in the family and the favoritism that Jacob showed to Joseph in the buying, you know, or the making of that coat that sometimes we call the coat of many colors. It's usually just described as this beautiful ornate coat that set him apart from the rest of his siblings. And John made 3 points in both that lesson and the next lesson that I thought were just excellent about God and how he works through us. Point number one is the purposes of God and are at work in hidden and unnoticed ways. God is working today, right now. We may not see it, we may not notice it, but he is. He's not a deistic God who created the world and went back to heaven and just kind of let things run on its own. He is intricately involved in my life, in your life, in the life of our community. Number two, the purposes of God are reliable. God is a promise keeper. What he has said he will do, he will accomplish. Which leads us to the third point, which is God's ways are at work regardless of human attitude and action. In other words, it doesn't matter whether or not we line up with God's plan. His plan will be fulfilled either through us or in spite of us. I oftentimes pray, God, speak either through me or in spite of me. Because sometimes I know that's what he has to do. And I appreciate John pointing these points out. I want to begin by asking you a question. Have you ever had a dream that you have never forgotten? And I'm thinking really a long time ago. Now, I know for some of our young people, a long time ago, maybe last year. But have you ever had a dream that, you know, normally when you have a dream, even a nightmare, by noon the next day it's gone. You know, it's kind of like a vapor, it appears. You wake up in the night, it shakes you, you know. I mean, sometimes you dream, I mean, just crazy things, and you're like, whoa, what was that all about? And then the next day it's gone. But sometimes you have a dream and it stays with you. I was in either the second or the third grade, so 7 or 8 years old, and I had a dream, and I still remember it to this day. 56, 57 years later, I can still picture the house, the gravel driveway, the kids from the neighborhood. I still remember the backyard, the front yard. I still remember what we were doing. It has stayed with me literally almost all of my life. Now you go, what does it mean? I don't have a clue. But it has stayed with me. And I suspect you've got a dream like that as well, or perhaps multiple dreams. There are dreams sometimes that I dream over and over and over again. And I think, am I in that dream again? Well, for Joseph, his life was not just created for a dream, but literally inspired and directed everything about him. John talked about how that he had these two dreams. In one of the dreams, they're out in the field, they're cutting wheat, they're tying them up in bundles, and his particular bundle of wheat ends up in the middle, and all of his brother's bundles of wheat end up surrounding him and bowing down to his sheaf of wheat. And of course, the brothers are like, really? First of all, you had that dream, but secondly, you had the courage to tell us. And then he has another dream, and in it, he's a star, and his brothers are stars, but they're surrounding him, and they're worshiping him. But in addition to his brothers is the sun and the moon, representing his father and mother, and he even told it to his dad, Israel. And of course, Israel's like, no, are you serious? He rebukes him and says, what is this dream you had? Will your mother and I and your brothers actually come and bow down to the ground before you? And the brothers are all jealous of him, but his father, Jacob, knows, wait a minute. If you remember the story of Jacob when he was fleeing from his brother Esau, he laid down one night, took a rock as his pillow, and he began to dream a dream of a stairway that led up to heaven and angels ascending and descending. We call it Jacob's ladder. And of course, he named the place Bethel, house of God. And that shaped who he was. And so he kept this matter in his mind, a whole lot like Mary did with incidents in the life of Jesus when he is young. I mean, she just kept these things in her mind and pondered over them. And you know that Jacob must have done so as well. When you get to the end of 37, and John mentioned this, they're planning on killing Joseph. Joseph's going to check on them. They see him walking up with that coat that just irritated the stew out of them. And so they grabbed him, they threw him in a pit, and they were going to go and kill him. But then text says that Judah said to his brothers, what will we gain if we kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites. Ishmaelites were descendants of Ishmael, distant cousins of theirs, lived down in the area of Midian down there, and said, and not lay our hands on him. After all, he is our brother, our own flesh and blood. And his brothers agreed. Now, I want you to remember this Judah here. Don't miss that. It's going to play a very, very important role. And so they sell their brother. Meanwhile, the Midianites, the Ishmaelites, sold Joseph in Egypt to Potiphar, one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard. And that brings in the end of chapter 37. And then what's strange is as you're reading through Genesis, you come to chapter 38 and you all at once go, okay, what's going on? Subject just changed. It's not about Joseph anymore. Or is it? You see, chapter 38 focuses on Judah, the brother who wanted to sell him as a slave into Egypt. And it focuses on his life and tells a story, and it's one of the strangest stories in the book of Genesis. Basically, Judah had three sons. And his oldest son got old enough to marry a wife, and so he finds a wife for her by the name of Tamar. The only problem is Judah's oldest son is a wicked young man, and so God basically executes him, leaving Tamar without any children. And back then the policy was that if a man died without having children, his next brother down would marry his widow. And so that's what Judah does. He gives his second son to Tamar in order to raise up children for his first son as well as his second son. Only problem is the second son didn't want to do that. And so he refused to honor his brother. God gets upset and God executes the second one. At which point Judah gets a little concerned. Before I bring that up, let me just mention, he basically says to Tamar, you wait until my youngest son is old enough, and then I'll give him to you. But he never intends to do so because he is thinking, this girl is bad luck, right? You know, if someone's been married to someone, and every time, you know, her husband dies, it's under strange circumstances, after three or four, you need to say, wait a minute. I don't know if I want to date this person or not. And that's what's going on in Judah's mind. And so Judah refuses to give his youngest son to Tamar. Tamar knows that. Time passes and Judah loses his wife. And Tamar knows what kind of man he is. And Tamar knows he's going on a trip. And so she dresses up like a harlot and goes and stands on the side of the road and Judah did exactly what she expected him to do, and the next thing you know, she's with child. And word gets back to Judah, says, hey, your daughter-in-law Tamar's with child. And Judah's response is, bring her out and have her burned to death. How dare she do this? And of course, they bring her out, and she brings with her some items, a cord, a staff, and a seal, which a seal was a ring that had stuff carved into it that identified who you were. And she basically said, by the way, why don't you go ahead and kill the person who got me pregnant, and here's their stuff, and it all belongs to Judah. And Judah's response to this incredibly embarrassing situation is to say, she is more righteous than I. Really? Yes. Now you go, okay, so why the story? Because in chapter 39, Joseph's character is contrasted to Judah, the very brother who had him sold. In other words, let's put Judah, who sells his brother, and Joseph, who is the one being sold, let's put them up side by side and see when it comes to morality, which one stands out. And you probably already know the rest of the story. Joseph's taken down to Egypt. Potiphar, who's an Egyptian official, he's literally the captain of the guard. That word captain means simply chief of the guard. We don't know if he's chief of the guards that guard Pharaoh, chief of the guards that guard the prison. I mean, we don't know what role he plays. But anyway, he buys him from the Ishmaelites and brings him into his house. And the text begins in verse 2 powerfully. The Lord was with Joseph so that he prospered. And he lived in the house of his Egyptian master. Now, I want you to think about that just for a moment. The Lord was with him so that he prospered. Joseph is prospering in a foreign land where he doesn't know the culture. He doesn't speak the language. He's all by himself, away from his family, and he's now a slave. Someone owns him. Now, I don't know about you, but at least from my perspective, that's not prospering real well. I mean, goodness gracious. That's like somebody saying, well, you know, Les and June were really prospering. They were living in a house trailer. He was climbing under houses, insulating houses, and she was working up at such and such store. I mean, I'm describing the first summer we were married together. And you're like, weren't you prospering? Y'all, we didn't have a penny to our name. You've ever heard the old phrase, living on love? It's all we had. I'm here to tell you. And I had made the foolish decision that we could get married for the same price we were living single. Now, guys, if y'all are thinking that, it doesn't work. It doesn't. But anyway, that's another story. And so the story goes on, and what made Joseph prosper is what was driving him. Joseph had a God-given dream that shaped how he looked at everything else in life. One of the things John talked about was the lens that you look at the world through. And as far as Joseph was concerned, the lens that he looked at through the world was a dream that God had given to him that he knew had come from God, and he knew somehow God would be faithful to it. And so even though he was a slave in Egypt, he knew God is still at work in my life. I'm reminded of the Apostle Paul, who's in a prison. I mean, he's in a prison. And you're like, okay, Paul, what sustains you while you're behind bars? And he says, let me tell you what it is. I want to know Christ. Yes, I want to know the power of his resurrection and participation in his sufferings. I want to become like him in his death. And so somehow attaining to the resurrection from the dead. I mean, here's Paul saying, you want me to tell you what I want? If prison is part of the sufferings of Christ, bring it on. If being in jail is a part of following Jesus, bring it on. If dying is a part of following Jesus, bring it on. As long as, Lord, you let me participate in that resurrection event. Which calls him to write in the next chapter, rejoice in the Lord always. And I'll say it again, rejoice. So can I ask you a question? What drives you? What's your God-given dream or dreams? Do you have them? People oftentimes ask me, why did you become a preacher? And my response is, when I was 12 years old, I came home one Sunday. I was living in Frankfort, Kentucky. And I just knew that's what I wanted to be. And from then on, I never thought about being anything else. I always wanted to be a preacher. And when June agreed to go out with me when I was in high school, and we got to talking, I said, you know, I want to be a preacher. And June said, well, I've always wanted to be a preacher's wife. Boy, my face lit up. There's not a lot of girls who say that, I promise you. I mean, she said, I've always known I'd be a preacher's wife. And I'm like, all right, God, I get the point. What's your God-given dream? I suspect you already know it. I suspect something immediately came in your mind. Is that what drives you? It's what should drive us. The text goes on when his master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord gave him success in everything he did. Now, you need to know something. Potiphar didn't believe in the Lord. Potiphar's a pagan. He worships the Egyptian gods. But he knows that some god is behind Joseph. No one is as successful as this guy is. Not unless the gods are with him. And so Potiphar recognizes that and basically puts everything under him. I mean, before long, this kid who, you know, maybe late teens, now 20, 21 years old, and he's now over this entire house of Potiphar, slaves and servants and everything that went on in a house in Egypt back then to a man who was quite powerful. But you know, anytime God gives you a dream, Satan wants to burst that dream. And we see that taking place in the next text, because what's fascinating about chapter 39 is it begins with God was with Joseph and it ends with God was with Joseph, and then right smack in the middle, sandwiched in between those two, is Satan trying to blow up the dream. And watch how he tries to do it. Now, Joseph was well built and handsome. And after some time, the wife of Joseph's master began to desire Joseph. One day she said to him, have physical relations with me. I mean, here it is. Now the temptation's coming. Joseph, what are you going to do? And I love the very next verse, but he refused. Man, you see that and it's like, I mean, three words, and yet three of the most powerful words in the world when it comes to bursting your dream. He refused. And so how do you not destroy your God-given dream? Now, a lot of preachers would call this, how do you overcome temptation? Okay, I get that. But it's temptation that messes with the dream. So how do you not destroy your God-given dream? Number one, you prepare for temptations before they come. One of the things I love about the response of Joseph to Potiphar's wife is you can tell he had been preparing for this moment. And he had the answer just right off the bat. With me in charge, he told her, this is Joseph speaking to Potiphar's wife, my master does not concern himself with anything. Notice that, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house. Everything he owns, he's entrusted to my care. No one is greater in this house than I am. My master has withheld nothing from me except you, because you're his wife. The first thing you see is this incredible respect Joseph had for Potiphar. My master. He didn't say Potiphar. He said he's my master. And he's put me over everything except you. And the first thing you see is a guy who understood what Jesus said when he said, can I tell you what the second greatest commandment is? Love your neighbor as yourself. Here was a young man who said, I can't do this because I respect your husband too much. And then he responded, and then how could I do such a wicked thing and sin against God? I mean, that's what I love about Joseph is, I mean, first of all, love your neighbor as yourself, but the first one is love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, and with all your strength. If you'll do that, you'll not sin against God. I mean, Joseph, before the law was even given, knew that what the law encompassed was two simple commandments. Love God and love your neighbor as yourself. I love Job. We went through Job here a few weeks ago, but in the story of Job, Job in defending himself, he said, can I tell you what I did a long time ago? He said, I made a covenant with my eyes not to look lustfully at a young woman. I mean, one of the things that's amazing about the book of Job is Job's own wife is telling him, why don't you curse God and die? And yet, you know, Job simply says, you're talking like a foolish person. You know, no. And at the end of the story, they're still married. Why? Because Job, like Joseph, has said, you know what? I'm going to follow God, and I'm not going to sin against my brother. Number two, you avoid the places that triggers temptations. Triggers are everything. You know that. I mean, if you'll just think right now, the biggest weakness you have in your life, there are triggers that set it off. I mean, we all know that. I was in the office this last week, and Susie came to me and said, hey, Brian's mom sent over a coconut cake. It's in the kitchen. Now, y'all, this is not just any coconut cake. This is one of those handmade, moist, sweet, incredible to die for coconut cakes. And, of course, I'm like, okay, it's here. If God didn't want me to eat it, he wouldn't have sent it over here, right? Triggers. We all have them. You turn over to Genesis 39. Of course, Potiphar's wife is basically tempting him every time he comes into the house. And the Bible says the woman talked to Joseph every day, but he refused to have physical relations with her or even spend time with her. Joseph knew, got to get away from the trigger. I've got to avoid that, which would lead me into sin, which is fascinating. You turn over to Proverbs 7, Solomon, who had heard of the sin of his mother and his father, David and Bathsheba. And years later, he's writing to his sons, and he says, listen, as I stood at the window of my house, looking out through the shutters, watching the mindless crowd stroll by, I spotted a young man without any sense. In the book of Proverbs, you're either foolish or you're wise. Here's a young man who's acting foolish. And notice the text there. Arriving at the corner of the street where she lived. He knew where she lived. But not just that. Then turning up the path, turning down the street that leads to her house. And then, of course, he says, and it was dusk, the evening coming on, the darkness thickening into the night. And then here's what Eugene Peterson, how he translates it, and I love it. He says, before you know it, he's trotting behind her like a calf led to the butcher shop. Wow. That kind of stirs up images in your mind. And so you stay away from the triggers that would lead you into sin. First of all, you prepare for temptations before they come, but then you just stay away from the things that you know you're weak in. But then number three, sometimes you have to run. I love the way the text says this. One day, Joseph's in the house. Everybody's gone except Potiphar's wife. She comes up once again, come and have physical relations with me. She grabs his cloak, and he runs and leaves it behind as he runs out of the house. I love what one commentator said. Joseph had a major problem with coats. I mean, his brothers ripped off the first one and Potiphar's wife ripped off the second one. Joseph, stay away from coats. But he got away. He got away. You know, I can't help but think of the Apostle Paul as Paul reflected on Joseph's life. I see him studying under Gamaliel as a young man going, yes, that's the way you do it. And years later, he'll write in his epistles things like, run, run from immoral behavior. This is from sexual immorality. Run from it. Run from idolatry in any form. I mean, you run. Don't even go near the temple. You avoid it at all costs. And you turn over to 1 Timothy 6, right near the end of his life. And Paul, once again, Timothy, don't let this happen to you. Run away from these things, which, by the way, this is the chapter on the love of money. And here's Paul saying, don't fall in its trap. Many have, and it's destroyed them. Don't you do it. You run from it. I just imagine with all the lotteries being up around $1 billion, the difference between those who run to buy the lottery ticket and those who run away from the love of money. Of course, Potiphar's wife tells on him. Tells Potiphar, and Potiphar's furious when the master heard the story his wife told him, saying, "This is how your slave treated me." He burned with anger. But here's my question. Anger with whom? Anger with Joseph? Or anger with his wife? You see, I find it hard to believe that Potiphar didn't know what kind of woman he was married to. And by the way, it doesn't tell us. Now, most people take it's anger because, look, Joseph's master took him, put him in prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined. But can I ask you a question? I mean, is that the punishment for attempted sexual assault in that time period? Do you know what a master did to his slave when he disobeyed him? He executed him. And yet, Potiphar doesn't execute Joseph. He puts him where the royal prisoners are kept, which begs the question, so who is Potiphar angry at? And I'm reminded of the story of the prodigal son when the dad begs the older brother to go into the party, and then the story just ends, and everybody wants to know, did he go in? That's the point of the story. And so he's put in prison, but I want you to notice again what happened. So the warden put Joseph in charge of all those held in the prison, and he was made responsible for all that was done there. The warden paid no attention to anything under Joseph's care, and you just once again have to go, why? What's going on? I mean, he leaves Potiphar's house, he goes into prison, and now he's running the prison. Why? And once again, the text says, because the Lord was with Joseph and gave him success in whatever he did. And so whether you find yourself in temptation or find yourself in prison or find yourself a slave to whatever it could be, as long as you put your faith in the Lord, he's going to be with you. And he's going to prosper you. And you may say, it's not prosperity in a prison. It would be for Joseph. I mean, eventually he would go to the highest ranks in the world. All began there in that prison. Never underestimate what God is doing, even in the darkest moments. And by the way, can I tell you what's even more special for those of us who are children of God today? Is not only God with us, but for those who have believed in Jesus and been baptized, God is in us. Through his Holy Spirit. And he's saying, you have all the power available. It's time to fight the war. And so how do you keep Satan from bursting your God-given dream? Fight him with everything you've got. That's what Joseph did, and that's what we need to do. Now, if today you're struggling with that, we're here for you. God understands sometimes. Lee did a great job talking about the grace and mercy we need to come before the throne of God, because sometimes, unlike Joseph, we're not that strong. God is still here to lift us up, to strengthen us, and to save us. If you need to come to him, why don't you come to him right now as we stand and sing.